and they're, you know, 4 feet or 5 feet high, so you don't have to get them and stuff like that. But they're constantly having to come up with something new. Now, there are consumers who will buy everything that's new. I have a cousin who should go unnamed that I'm sure has on order 20 8K screens if they're out yet, you know, just because it's the greatest thing and he could show people in his home theater that this is 8K. And yeah, it's really colors are very well, you know, very good for a $20,000 monitor. But it's all consumer, electronics industry trying to stay alive. I'll drop for any comments, questions.
Yes, Rich, I totally agree with you. It's a matter of finance. Company that makes, that needs to make money. Their stockholders don't enjoy it when they don't make money. And so they have to promote things with high premiums. Regular high-definition televisions are now commodities. They're churning them out in China for chump change. I mean, I'm sure everyone has seen the Black Friday ads for beautiful HD and even some 4K televisions for incredibly lower prices than they've ever seen before, and the industry is looking for a new hook. A few years ago, they tried 3D. That failed abysmally, so they went back to the drawing board, and they came up with 4K, and they're having problems getting software for that, but despite it, in Japan, where it's a really serious business problem with them, Korea probably just as well, they're going to try and promote 8K. You know it's going to happen. Even though it's not necessarily of any value, there'll be guys out there who will need to have it, you know, like they need a grand piano parked in front of the house. So that's the nature of consumerism.
Well, I went out there to become president of Columbia or whatever, but ended up, when I say out there in L.A., ended up working for Henry with an infamous, crazy Eddie type of consumer electronics. They sold cameras, they started out as cameras. They got into stereos and stuff like that. When I came in, that's what I started selling to rock and roll bands, speakers. And then Sony came out with the Betamax, and I was the first one, because we were in L.A., and that's where the stuff was coming in from Japan. I was actually the first one to sell Betamax. And so I can guarantee another part of the problem, or the push, to Justin talking about 4K and 8K, are salesmen. Just want to make the sale. They don't know what they're saying, you know, selling in the first place, but want to make the sale, and you've missed the nation. You have mom and pop coming in, you know, to buy a LCD, whatever, and things I've heard in Best Buy make me cringe. A couple of times, I went over to the kid, the salesman, and said, you're absolutely wrong. So that's a component of the problem in pushing this stuff on the poor consumer. Basically, it is, as you said, Roy, there's an actual mathematical formula of how far you have to be away from the screen to get advantage at a certain, you know, resolution. And you know, maybe there are some installers, high-end installers that tune your room for video and audio and the whole thing and lighting. But most of it, people are just being sold this stuff, and it's really tough. How sharp is sharp? How sharp do you need it? So I even watch videos in Best Buy of balloons and guys surfing through balloons, you know, and I said to the guy, you know, you know,
go on
some regular stuff.
You
don't have any regular stuff.
Okay, Rich, but you know, like the old saying goes, the fish stinks from the head down. If the running the major consumer product companies didn't pump out marketing and software to show off, and the products, the salesmen wouldn't have anything to sell. It's not like they're making this up and just selling a con. They're selling products that are of dubious value, and some would say that that's the high point of salesmen, that anyone can sell something that's useful, but you need a really good salesman to sell the proverbial refrigerator in Antarctica. So, you know, that's the nature of commerce, unfortunately. You did bring up something way back that I'd just like to kind of put a dot on. Calibrating television sets. Some people consider it a scam. If you have a good eye for television, getting someone to legitimately calibrate a television set that you just bought out of the box for your environment can be a very nice thing. Some people appreciate it. Other people just set it for the same setting in the showroom and don't care if it burns holes in their eyes. So calibrating televisions is an art form, and for people with the sensibilities, they can benefit from that. So I just wanted to put my 2 cents worth as far as television monitor calibration.
There's a website, RTing, the letter R, then T-I-N-G, RTing.com, and they only raise of their analysis of a flat screen is breathtaking. It's just breathtaking. And now I've come up with some tricks, calibration numbers. They follow its nuances, and I throw a lot of them. I'm talking about 28 foots, 38 else in the screen. Take that amount. You know, some of them do, some of them don't. If anybody wants to see how far, RTing.com. Excuse me. There's one more thing I wanted to say, and that was, again, you know, guys like us who've been in electronics, for, you know, me, I've been in since I'm 12, I'm 70 years old, know that, you know, as I said before, stereo amp, you know, amp, there hasn't been much improvement on stuff that, you know, high-end stuff that we bought, you know, 30 years ago, you know, 20 years ago. But one technology is blowing my mind. Everybody should take a look at it. No, I didn't know what this Chromecast and Roku and Fire Sticks were. Well, I got a $35 Roku stick, and I am just mind blown on what this little thing flabbergasted on a world that is opening up, because you can make your own Roku channel. I'm putting it up already on our website. But you can now communicate. You don't have to do it on YouTube like professionals. You know, you have your own little TV channel. Much better than having your own little videos. So I just wanted to make people aware. Now, I'm going to spend $35 on one of these Roku sticks. I believe the Roku stick technology, though their interface is called, innovation electronic. All right, boy, thanks. Guys, WQC.
Okay, Rich. A Roku is a very good product. There are a bunch of them around now, thanks to the incredibly high bandwidth of the internet and the strength of the internet and servers that can stream stuff this way and that. I kind of cut my own cable and I use YouTube. There's a lot of streaming services and there's a lot of technology that's being developed. So yeah. There's useful technology, there's just technology to crow about, but doesn't really mean much, and some people know the difference, some people don't, but if it gives people pleasure and it doesn't put them into the poorhouse, then so be it.
Absolutely. If you know, my cousin's a multi-gazillionaire, and let him buy all the 8K and trucks, so be it. But, those of us who have been into electronics for eons and eons, to me, it's all ridiculous. Today. Anyway, that's about it on that subject. So thanks, Roy, for bringing up something that I can talk about. And we'll see you down the line, as they say. Whiskey to you, brothers.
Hey, Sir Jack.
Derek.
Yeah, I'm listening to you guys. And I gotta really say a couple things. Where is it? You feel that the consumer electronics manufacturers are the driving force behind a lot of this stuff. And that's just simply not the case. they just reap the benefits of it. For example, high-definition television, HDTV, is actually not driven by anything other than the NHK. In 1980, I have a monitor from 4K, literally developed by the NHK. In 60, the first time I saw it at NAB. Many of these things were driven by technology organizations. Let me just... the Japanese NHK and a couple of other organizations within Japan, they had the foresight of having specific applications when they developed for it. Actually, the first applications were medicine. There's many of the today's types of robotics, like Da Vinci, really, for years, independent upon the image sensing thing that's developed by the various different creators of these products. And again, yes, the consumer benefit is put a 4K set next to a 2K set, and you move back 50 feet, you can't tell the difference between them. But the thing with the HDR and a few other things that have now rolled into 4K sets, the high dynamic range, the greater amounts of colors that are being capable of being visited, actually make for a much more pleasant experience, especially if you're a sports person. You want to see stuff in detail that you haven't seen before. Yes, there's a minimum distance from where you're going to be actually be able to see the difference. If you get right up close to it, you'll see stuff that you're not going to see in the 2K monitor, but that's just simply the way it is. But the content is another issue, especially with 4K limited extravagance. If you're talking about stuff that's been done on film, film has, you have that frosty curve of the silver halides that you're working with. You actually have a little bit better resolution than you've got in 4K, so you have an awful lot of content there. The problem is transmission or getting it to the broad public. That's where MPEG 4 and 264 and 265, and now something called HDEC, the various different forms of mathematical compression that go beyond the spatial or the temporal problems that we've had in the past as technologies move ahead. It's not all a profit-based thing. A lot of the stuff comes from other uses, and just because they're there and they can be exploited, and by the way, there are licenses for Peg 4 and various other things. There are actually technology organizations getting the little 2 cents for every consumer device that's out there, so just the manufacturers make money. But also, the research going into these higher technology things becomes available because the consumers are putting money into it. And as you, ramp up mass production of these various devices, it's not all, greediness that's bringing this all about. So, KC2DS, K to again.
Hey, Eric, I don't think it's all some kind of conspiracy. I just think that the consumer electronics manufacturers jump on these things and over-promote them, promising things that are a little bit above what the average person will actually get out of the experience. And the trouble is that it's not only high resolution. There are other things that are being improved that have a much more, to me, important effect than probably to you. There's refresh rate, there's dynamic range, there's the color gamut that you mentioned. They're all being tweaked up as well, and those, I think, will have a more dramatic effect to people with a decent eye than the heightening of the resolution. So I agree that there's a place for these things. I'm just thinking that the consumer electronic manufacturers tend to abuse concepts and promote them to groups of people that don't necessarily need them. And I understand that eventually down the line, the economics of scale will drop the price to a commodity, just as HDs are now commodity products. But a lot of people end up having to pay R&D prices before that happens.
Oh, I totally agree with you. I mean, the first HD camera and the first HD VTR were about $1 million a piece. I had one of them. first really good size AC monitor was about 60 grand.
Well, it's like anything in broadcasting, you've got to pay for the on form. And that's why in the early days, VCRs cost 80,000. I bought, let's see, in 1996, I bought a whole bunch of digital VCRs. They were about, I got a good deal on them, about 35,000 a piece. Get the concept. There's only so many TV stations that are going to buy those types of devices. Although 10 years down the line, I mean, you look at a little a Chromecast stick or a Roku stick, that's a lot of years past development brought down into a little FPGA. So you're making thousands of them, quite the cheap. But, yeah, I agree with you. But when you take an initial audience like sports people, you put them in, you don't tell them what it is, you put them in front of two or three different sets, and you will find that they will gravitate towards one particular thing, and that in the case of HD over 4K, they gravitate towards the 4K. As far as refresh rates go, people don't understand what that's about. They don't understand the temporal aspect of it. They just know that the refresh rate is greater. But you actually haven't changed the frame rate of what's coming there. It's just you eliminate the inherent problems of the LCD having lag. You know, to increase the refresh rate, you eliminate some of the lag, but you're not actually improving the spatial, the temporal response of the images that you're seeing.
A lot of times people don't know why they like something, they just tend to like it. I mean, a bigger color gamut gives you much more different colors. Now, if you don't care and you find washout colors as good as anything else, then it's unnecessary for you, or whatever the person might be. I think, unfortunately, it's very easy to tweak the brightness and the intensity of an HD monitor and kind of tone down the display of a 4K and have an average consumer look at it in the store and say, I'd like that HD better.
This, once again, this is, so it goes from professional to
got a problem with his echo link. Perfect class, unclushed, perfect lights at arm point. Problem with his echo link. He starts off having decent audio and then it just disappears. But, yeah, no, I agree with you in terms of what the stores do. But if you take two sets that are properly set up, you're watching a movie and its dramatic effect is in terms of lighting, for example, you know, your typical HD or even a 525 set, the contrast ratio is less than 100:1. When you go into a good theater, and no longer can you go into a good theater and see film anymore, but you'll have a contrast ratio that'll be 10,000:1, and we're slowly getting to the ability to produce that. So in terms of, you know, what someone might see on two properly adjusted sets, you're going to like, or you're going to get a more dramatic feel from the set that's capable of reproducing that set of grayscale. And you'll find that people will pick the larger set of grayscale over the other set of grayscale. You can set it up so the black and the whites are exactly the right level, but the in-between. The older technology had a tendency to solarize things in terms of trying to create grayscale. If you go back to the plasma sets, they don't actually do it by changing the intensity of the light. They do it by dithering pixels. There's so many little tricks that went along the way as the technology improved, those things fall by the wayside. AC2GS, KU2GS.
AC2GS. Well, occasionally, though, specifications technologically are able to be improved, and audiences hate them. Recently, a couple of years ago, directors were playing around with increasing the frame rate of their films, of their movies, making it much more per second than the 24 per second that everyone's used to. And when a lot of people looked at it, it looked like they were watching a television set, and they really hated it. So sometimes you're stuck, even though you can technologically improve specifications, per se, your audience doesn't approve and won't pay for it.
No, totally agree. Within the industry, they call it soap opera vision. After you increase the frame rate,
It starts to look more like you're looking through a piece of glass out somebody's window as opposed to a dramatic piece of celluloid that has a SR backing, a plastic that you're projecting through, and also the bicouplers within the silver halides that are on the film. Actually, they spent a lot of years trying to develop the algorithm to duplicate that, because nowadays we shoot film, motion picture, electronically. And by the way, people who think they're watching 24 frames per second actually aren't. If you were seeing 24 frames per second, you would perceive an awful lot of flicker. What projectors do is know that a camera shoots 24 frames per second. The projector in the theater actually projects each frame twice to eliminate the flicker, to create that psychological effect so that you don't perceive, like, you still get strobing and other issues. But the concept of what is a classic dramatic production, that's why we stick to that particular framework. It's taken many years to create the algorithms to try to reproduce the gamut and the reciprocity curve and the knee of the way silver halides are exposed into the electronic media. So generally, they shoot 4K, which is true 4K, which is a square pixel, as opposed to what we see, which we call 4K, but it's actually UHD, which is a different shape. It's actually not 4K by 4K, it's 3840. Anyway, that's a whole different story. But the point is, the type of thing that you're projecting, like Doug Trumbull created his thing called FlowScan, which, by the way, IMAX used for a while. They use it for special applications where it's actually 60 frames a second. But it's the content, and if you use it based upon the content that you're shooting, then it's affected. If you're just using it for the sake of technology, then you're wasting your time.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the ultimate truism. It even pertains to 3D. You know, Avatar was designed around doing 3D. They did it well. People enjoyed it, and they actually sold some 3D televisions. Then everyone else just kind of threw it on as an afterthought, and the entire concept blew up on everyone. And by the way, Rich, I'm sorry, you kind of doubled with Eric, and because your Echo Link audio is very low, we can barely hear you, unfortunately. So blame it on Echo Link, I guess.
All right, well, it looks like on Echo Link, the audio is a little better now. Is it? Because I have, I want to ask Eric that question again.
Yes, right now I can hear you very well. Lou, who's also on Echo Link, suggested that you adjust the audio settings. I'm assuming that's what you did, but you sounded good at the beginning before, and then something strange happened, and we lost about, you lost about 10 dB of audio.
I know I did, and then all of a sudden it came back, and I touched nothing. So I don't know what it is. I am speaking a little louder, but Eric, if you're still there, I was watching at my friend's home in L.A. Are you seeing just took a sip. Eric, I was watching Out of Africa on this 88-inch screen in a big living room in L.A., and it looked like video. It did not look like film. It didn't have that quote-unquote film quality. It looked just like video, and I couldn't believe what I was seeing. It had lack of depth of field and everything else. Would that have been rescanning it for, for broadcast or cable cast?
All right, let me tell you what Hollywood has been doing. They generally shoot raw, okay? And sometimes it'll be 30, sometimes it'll be 24, and sometimes it'll be 60. When they prepare a film for a theatrical release, they will then run an algorithm on it, and it will actually be brought down to 24, and the algorithm will create the celluloid look film. A lot of times when they release for video, they will actually take the raw content at the original rate that it was shot at, which is more compatible to, say, if you're looking at something that's like 720p, which is actually 60 frames a second as opposed to 30, and doesn't have a 3-2 pull down,
you will get that video look from it. A lot of times, you will see stuff released on DVD, and it will have a very light version of the reduction algorithm, and it will have this video look to it too. So, yeah, that kind of stuff is happening more and more. The cases of older stuff, which was actually shot on film, all the post-processing done on film and released on film, put onto a telecine, depending upon what their distribution audience is, a lot of times it'll be brought back to 30, which means you're going to do a 3-2 pull down on it. And the stuff that's going to go, say, MPEG-4, that actually might be done at 60. So you will see more and more of the video look of the stuff that you saw in the theater that looks beautiful in film and now starts to look like you're looking at it through a glass window.
That's exactly
what it looked like.
And,
I gotta tell you that your microphone is intermittent. Either the cable going into the connector or the largely little 1/8-inch plug on the back of your computer is not cutting it. You're not making a good connection. Now you have absolutely no audio. May I suggest if you have Echo Link on your cell phone, use it.
All right. Anyway, Roy, you take it. I've said enough. Thanks. So if you want to try again, you know, put it in the text and we'll make space for you. But I think we sort of did this subject as much as it could be done. We have a gentleman who drops in via Echo Link from Tokyo, Japan. Maybe one day I'll ask him if he knows anyone who's watching 8K there.
Now, by the way, you can buy 8K here now. But the interesting about the 8K that I saw at the last NAB show is the sort of artificial intelligence of upconverting, and that's getting to be quite an interesting science.
Yeah, I'm perpetually amazed that you can kind of trick people's vision into seeing detail that isn't there, but Adobe Photoshop has been doing it for many years, so it's just some clever engineering.
No, it's kind of more than that. Actually, interestingly enough, years ago I used to work for a computer graphics lab that developed a lot of the algorithms that became Photoshop. And I'll tell you that the first version of HD was done by a guy by the name of Dr. Bill Glenn, and he decided that you know, he used to work for CBS Labs. He's down at Nova University. His wife was a physiological psychologist, and they did studies on what the eyeball can see, just like Dolby did studies on what the ear can hear. That's why in HD3, if you're looking at some orchestration, it's like the Beethoven 5th, and there's a little triangle in the background, HD3 says, you can't hear it, so I'm not going to bother to use up the data for that. But the point is, his concept of compatible 525 in HD was analog, with the VHF would be the standard 525 that you saw, and the HD part would be 3 megahertz up in the UHF. That's a whole bunch of long story, but that was the beginning of how some of these processes came about.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole great history of, well, I mean, there's a history for everything. There's a history for science, a history of engineering, you know, the history of developing radio from a bunch of spark gaps to what we have today. So it's all sort of fascinating, but I mean, this particular aspect almost strikes me as voodoo. Because you know, it's putting something. It's the perception of putting detail in after the fact, which fundamentally gives me a problem. Except that it's not the real detail. It's just the tricking your vision into assessing it as greater detail.
Oh, I totally agree. Actually, there's some manufacturers that sell these imaging systems. For example, most of the 3D movies that you see are not shot in 3D. They're actual 3D simulations. In Avatar, you only shot about 30% of the film was actually done in 3D. The rest of it was these algorithmic simulations
of 3D.
Yeah, but he got away with it. I mean, I watched Avatar in 3D, and it's beautiful. I haven't seen anything that comes even vaguely close to that.
No, that's all in the planning. I mean, look at Todd O, what he did with the Cinerama back in those days. But actually, most 3D movies that are released in 3D are not in 3D. They weren't shot in 3D. They were planned in a way that you can do 3D simulation very, very effectively. But what his name did with Avatar, he beyond planned that he shot the key things that he needed to shoot in 3D, and the rest of it was done by the algorithmic stuff that we currently use today.
Yep, and that was James Cameron. I've lost track of how many Avatars he plans to produce back to back. I think I lost count after the idea of having 12 of them. I think he's going to live. He's assuming he's going to live to be about 350 years.
I know what you mean, but you know we can go on and on about this. But anyway, that's it. ACQDSK2J.
Okay, unless there's any further comments, I'll move on to the next topic. Okay, there's no place safe from the scourge of superbugs. A new study suggests, not even space. According to the study, samples of bacteria resistant to several antibiotics have been found on the International Space Station. And while bacteria may not have made any astronauts sick yet, the authors say it's pretty likely that they can. The authors behind the study, published last week in BMC Microbiology, are primarily members of NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, which is managed by the California Institute of Technology. The laboratory is the major research hub for NASA's robotic space and Earth science missions, such as the Mars Curiosity rover, and also runs NASA's Deep Space Network of satellites. The new study is actually an update to the researchers' ongoing work. In January, the same team published research looking into the bacterial genetics of samples swabbed from the surface of the ISS in 2015. Within these samples, they found more than 100 bacterial genes known to help make bacteria resistant to antibiotics, and strains belonging to a particular species of bacteria, called Enterobacter bugandesis, were resistant to all 9 antibiotics tested against them. In this latest study, they hope to figure out just how dangerous these strains could be to human health. So they compared the genetics of the ISS strains to 3 strains of E. bugandesis. Let me drop for a second. The ISS strains had a lot in common with the Earth strains, including genes associated with antimicrobial resistance and virulence, the potential of a microbe to infect a person. Based on these genetic similarities, the team estimated the ISS strains were 79% likely to be disease-causing pathogenic. Enterobacterial live most everywhere, including in our guts. Typically, they don't cause illness, but in people with weakened immune systems, such as hospital patients, they can become the source of serious life-threatening infection. And the recent discovery of E. bugandesis is known to cause sepsis, a too drastic an immune response to infection that can fatally shut down an organism, newborn and elderly. These opportunistic infections are bad enough, but antibiotic resistance has made them increasingly difficult to treat, and in space where medical resources are limited and astronauts tend to have weaker immune systems, a potential infection could be catastrophic. Luckily, the authors say there is no evidence these strains have caused any disease on board the ISS, and there's still plenty of work to be done to figure out just how much of a problem these bugs are, as well as whether the conditions of space travel are encouraging their growth or making them more dangerous. Let me drop it. One scientist, for instance, has speculated that microgravity might actually make bacteria evolve quicker than they would on Earth, or dampen the germ-killing effects of antibiotics. Future research will have to include experiments directly conducted in space. So if any of you are planning to book a trip to the ISS, remember to take your antibacterial soap. Let me drop for any questions. This is AC2GS. Thank you.
and 4 HPM.
Yes, Harry.
I use something that will kill any bacteria and all bacteria on this whole planet. It's called colloidal silver. I actually make it myself. And colloidal silver is also used in hospital burn units. They started using colloidal silver and spraying it on the open burn wounds to ward off possible staph infections or any kind of bacterial infection. Because it's the only thing on the planet that will kill all, and I mean all, bacteria. I had a situation where I had recent surgery, and my wound wasn't healing, and the doctors put me on all kinds of antibiotics, and I turned around and I says, you know, let me try my colloidal silver, and guess what? 3 days, the infection was gone.
Okay, good to hear, Harry. Yes, colloidal silver is bacteria static, bactericidal. It doesn't do anything clever that cells can easily evolve around, so you're safe as far as that's concerned. I'm sure there must be some problem with colloidal silver because there's ultimately problems with almost everything and anything. The silver has been well known as a bactericidal agent.
Yeah, I always keep a colloidal silver on hand. Matter of fact, my wife keeps asking me to make it because she uses it to clean the kitchen countertops and the cutting boards that she uses, you know, for preparing food.
Okay, like I said, very effective, but people can misuse it as well, unfortunately. Every so often you'll see a YouTube of some guy who decided that he was going to ingest the silver, and it leaves a very strange effect. It gives people's skin a blue tinge, so they look like they come from Avatar, if you will.
You know, what's funny is, this is N4 HPM. I'm very much aware of that. And the reason that they get that tinge is when they make their colloidal silver, they're not using distilled water. And what happens is, apparently, I guess the colloidal silver reacts with some minerals in such a way that it will cause you to get that skin condition. Like myself, I drink colloidal silver, but I'm not drinking it all the time. I kind of reserve it for when as needed type thing. But the consensus is if you do drink it, you know, every day, which I know some people who do, they've never had the skin problem. And the ones that have had the skin problem, they were asked whether or not they used distilled water. And the answer was no, they used regular tap water.
Okay, that's an interesting little fact. I got to look that one up as well. It's more dramatic when they just show these poor guys who look like Smurfs. It's very unfortunate. It's not a good look, Blue.
No, it's not. I think it's quite, humorous, but it doesn't go away. Once you do it, it's permanent.
Yeah, you gotta really like that look to try it out, because once you bought it, you own it.
Okay, well, that's my 2 cents on colloidal silver. Like I said, it's very easy to make. As long as you're using distilled water. I use 2 4-inch pure silver rods and space them about an inch apart. I got an insulator that, you know, holds them apart. And I put a 24-volt power supply on it, and I do basically a gallon at a time. I keep the electrodes in for roughly 3.5 to 4 hours, the yield that I get out of it, you know, when I after I filter out some of the, you know, I go through two coffee filters when I filter it, and then I do a parts per million test on it, and usually it roughly averages out to around anywhere from 13 to 16 parts per million.
Okay, that's all fascinating. It's one of the great things about this TechNet. Learn something new every time I come on it.
Yeah, I actually wish they had something down here in Florida like this, but they don't. You know, I'm lucky that I have two repeaters in the area and a DMR repeater, but for me to actually do better would be, using my DMR hotspot.
Oh, that's another great topic for conversation, hotspots. They seem to be one of the newer, more interesting gadgets that a lot of people are trying as well. But it's sort of a shame that there isn't something like that in Florida. Actually, Dick was talking to a gentleman who was telling him about a technical net that was someplace in Florida, and there was a consideration of kind of hooking them both together because they go on Sunday as well.
Maybe that's over in the Orlando area. I know there's a little more activity over there. I'm over on the East Coast and the Space Coast. I'm actually not far from the Kennedy, Cape Canaveral launch site. And I get to watch the rockets go off whenever they go off, right from my own backyard.
Well, that certainly sounds like loads of fun. You can't do that in Brooklyn.
No, you can't. But, you know, the one thing that pushed me out of New York, I guess that's another big topic, is the taxes. I said, that's it, I'm done. And my wife and I picked everything up. So we loaded up my motorhome, and I said, okay, we're not going back up north until we find a property in Florida. And that's what we did. We came down with the motorhome, lived out of the motorhome for a couple of months, you know, looking at all kinds of real estate, and then finally found a place and made a decision and to buy it. And then once we took possession of the property, we came up, packed everything up, and sold the house.
Okay, so all's well that ends well. We won't get into tax because that's politics, and I like to tell people that we save that for the political net that begins at 12:05 on this repeater. But it's sort of a joke because we shut down the repeater at 12:05. Anyway, this has been and continues to be the Science Report. And I just want to mention the usual things before I call it a night. If you want to suggest any topics, if you have any questions, if you have any comments, if you refute what I say and have better explanations, the email address that you can send it to me is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And the few stories that I had a chance to talk about will be listed on my webpage at roy.ac2gs.com. Just point the browser at royac2gs.com, and you'll get the links. Now, don't try and send me an email from that page where it says, email web host, because I'm not the web host there. So please use the proper address. But anyway, this is Fun Science News Report for me, and next up is Paul with the Space Report.
Thank you, Roy, and we sure did get listener participation tonight. Well done. We like listener participation. So, Paul, what has NASA and all those other space agencies been doing? The InSight looks like it's doing extremely well. I guess it's going to be digging itself a hole into the Martian soil pretty soon.
WS2L, K2RIW, go right ahead, Paul.
Yeah, well, the time frame on that will probably be a month or two, believe it or not. Before I go on, I'll just tell Harry down in Florida, he's got a launch coming up this Tuesday at 1:38 in the afternoon. You can watch the SpaceX CRS-16 cargo mission going up to the International Space Station. They'll be able to see that on Tuesday. So will we. We can watch it on NASA TV. But yeah, the InSight is doing very good. They figured out that it landed about 4 degrees, you know, on a tilt. They could go all the way up to 15 degrees, so they got well within the correct the amount of degrees for proper operation. They'll have no problem with their robotic arm. It set itself free. I saw the video on that. Let me drop it. Really hasn't moved much. It just disconnected itself from the locking position. Everything's all locked up when it travels from Earth to Mars. That's the first step. But it will take a couple of months once the robotic arm is moving around. They have a camera on that. They'll take different pictures of the area where, so they know where to put the seismometer down or the HP3, the heat mole probe is going to be digging itself 15 feet to the ground. They'll know where to put that with the arm. So that's good. Once they have to pop the little lens off the cover off the lens for better pictures, and they'll check it all out with that robotic arm. It hangs on a cable. We talked about this the other night, and it has a little cylinder filled with wax, and the wax will be heated, cool. To open up the little five-finger core to grab the different devices that they're going to put on the surface. Heat it up. The core will open, and then if you let it cool, it will grab a hold of whatever it's trying to grab a hold of. So this way, let's say it's about to put it down onto the surface. If you had a power failure temporarily for whatever reason, it won't drop into cold mode, closed position when they put these different experiments on the surface. So that's the story on that. It's doing good. I'll get reports from Jet Propulsion Laboratory on their website as the days go on. It's a 2-year mission, and going to look forward to getting all the mechanical stuff onto the planet, and then eventually all the science that they're going to get out of InSight. Drop it. Yeah. It landed in LCM Leticia, which is a very flat, open area. If anybody has followed the story, that's what they were looking for. Basically, a parking lot. They were very happy to have InSight land with no rocks around or anything. There's no rocks on the surface. There's probably no rocks underneath. And they have one particular experiment that's going to dig into the ground. And the last thing they want to do is hit a big rock when they're doing that. The Marco satellites worked out good. The Marco satellites followed InSight all the way to Mars and worked as very good repeaters. Crossband repeater, really, is the... InSight was transmitting UHF, and the Marco satellites, of two of them. One, they were both receiving UHF and then retransmitting it out on what they call X-band back to the Deep Space Network. So the vehicle was doing good. The whole thing weighed around 800 pounds. It landed, we didn't know that the solar panels opened up until the next day. Well, they knew it about 3 or 4 hours later, but I didn't find out until the next day. So they're successfully working. You can receive, they can get maybe 700 watts out of it. The first day, they got over 4,500 watt hours out of the 2 7-foot diameter solar panels. So they're recharging batteries and hopefully it'll keep this going for the next 2 years. And that's pretty much on that. I wanted to talk about a couple of important events coming up actually tomorrow, actually during this whole week. First of all, you're going to have the Expedition 58 mission launch from Kazakhstan. It's going to bring a crew of three up to the International Space Station. An American astronaut, Ann McLean, one of them. David Jacques from Canada, doctor. They always tend to have a doctor on a regular basis on board the space station. Right now you have Saron Unan, who's also a doctor. She's on board right now, and also an American. She'll be coming back very shortly. So they always like to have one on board. Also, the Russians, of course, are going to be flying the Soyuz up to the International Space Station. This is the first time they're actually sending a crew since last October when they had an abort. The abort caused the two, in that case, there was just two going up to the space station to come back and land back in Kazakhstan. Went up and came right back down. And they found out one of the liquid boosters that's attached to the rocket. There's four of them. They're supposed to separate at the same time. They're supposed to do like a backflip and they move away from the core rocket. One of them did not do that. Apparently, according to the Russians, the bottom of it didn't disconnect properly and caused the top part to not operate the oxygen thruster properly, and what they had is actually oxygen that's part of the oxygen, liquid oxygen inside the thruster to push the top away from the vehicle. Well, one of them didn't do that and actually started going forward and hit the core, and that triggered an immediate abort, and therefore that crew came back. So they think they have it all fixed. They're sending this crew up. One of the trips they have to do when they're up there is to do an EVA. One other problem that the Russians had was a hole drilled into one of the crew vehicles that's presently attached to the International Space Station. And they are going to go out, I believe, this week to investigate that. They sent two cosmonauts out to take a look at the hole on the outside. They know what it looks like on the inside. They believe they fixed it, but they just want to see what the outside looks like. Check everything out before they disembark and head back to land in the seven fields of Kazakhstan. Another show we could more or less watch, I'll call it a show, on NASA TV tomorrow at 11:45. We have a spacecraft called OSIRIS-REx. OSIRIS-REx was launched a while back. Goal is to go to an asteroid called Bennu. Well, it's almost there. Bennu is very close. I've seen pictures of the asteroid from OSIRIS-REx, and we're going to have a rendezvous tomorrow at 11:45. It'll come on, so you're not really going to see the thing touch down to it or do anything like that. You're still about a year and a half away from doing that. But they're going to get it close, and it'll stay there, and it'll somewhat orbit this asteroid for the next couple of years, actually. After rendezvous, it'll take pictures and all kinds of radar, scanning, and laser scanning, and they'll make a determination of where they're going to actually eventually touch the asteroid. Once they do, they're going to have a gadget on board that's going to go right up to it. It'll touch the asteroid. It'll shoot a blast of nitrogen into the asteroid, and dust, rocks, and pebbles will get sucked into this round disc, Grisby-like thing that will be at the end of a robotic arm. With that, it'll take that all that stuff and eventually put it into a sample return canister. And within a couple of years from now, it'll come through the atmosphere, I think 2023 or something like that, will come through the atmosphere and land in Utah. It takes many years to do this type of thing to eventually get something back from either the moon or asteroids or Mars. This particular mission will take, I think, overall about 5 years from start to finish. Another event that will take place also on the 3rd, which is also Monday, so three different events Monday. 1:30 in the morning will be the launch of Expedition 58 to the space station from Kazakhstan. 11:45, you're going to have OSIRIS-REx doing a rendezvous of a Bennu asteroid. And then you're going to have also close around that time, around 1:30, SpaceX plans on launching a rocket from Vandenberg, California, with the SS-0A mission. What that is, it's by an organization called Spaceflight. They paid for this whole $62 million launch to put on board 64 satellites from different countries and different companies, 64. And they plan on launching into a polar type orbit and releasing these satellites one at a time. They've got this gadget that stores them all, and it'll be at the front of the whole solar rocket, the whole spacecraft after it gets into orbit. And it'll rotate slowly, as it does, send these 64 CubeSats and mini-sats all off in different directions, pre-planned orbits. So that's an interesting flight because two reasons. One, because of the 64 satellites, and the other one because the booster that they're using will be reused for the third time. SpaceX, if anybody follows SpaceX, they know that they're famous for reusability. All the boosters in the past so far, and there's been dozens of them, that have been caught on a floating barge out at sea, or actually fly back now to Vandenberg Air Force Base, or once that leave Florida, come back and land in Florida, have been reused just once. And they were called Block 4. They were Falcon 9 boosters, and Block 4, model of that particular booster. Reusability was one time only. The new ones are Block 5. That's what, the only ones that fly now is Block 5. Some of them have already been reused twice, including this one that's going off tomorrow from Vandenberg Air Force Base. Flew twice. This will be the first time SpaceX flies a booster for a third time. If successful, if they're able to catch this thing downrange on the barge ship that they have floating out in the Pacific, they'll be able to bring that back and be able to reuse it again. The Block 5 Falcon 9 boosters are designed to fly 10 different times without really much work at all. After 10 times, they'll refurbish them to quite an extent, really take them apart, and then reuse them again for another 10 times, and so on and so forth. They predict up to 100 uses per booster. So you can see how they could drive the price of spaceflight down by all this reusability. And one of the parts of the spacecraft that they have been able to reuse is the fairing part. You have this, like spaceflight is sending this SSOA 64 satellites out. Well, before it goes up and it's sitting on a launch pad, it's encapsulated in this 5.5 meter diameter fairing. Separates the two pieces once it's up in space. they don't need it anymore. And they